Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Preece. This week, political scientist and author Elizabeth Saunders on why foreign policy elites matter.
To say someone is a foreign policy elite just means that they devote a lot of their time to thinking about foreign policy. It doesn't make them better or worse. It doesn't make them superior. It doesn't mean that they necessarily would be that great if you threw them in a think tank and asked them to talk about healthcare, because they don't follow those debates. Elites are really important for accountability. If the voters can only do it every 4 years, they need those elites to be passing judgment in a substantive way. Not all of them, but some of them have to. We want to understand the political incentives that drove these presidents and not sweep them under the rug, because if we are trying to improve policy and our understanding of how policy gets made, a broad brush demonization of everybody who makes these decisions is not going to get us very far.
Elizabeth Saunders, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
As you know, but our listeners don't know until right now, I've been interested in having you on here for quite a while now. I think I first reached out to you, a year and a half ago, saying, let's chat. But you did have a major project going on, and
yeah,
you were in the midst of it then.
Well, I wouldn't say the midst. I was more like, the project was about to graduate from high school. So this is a project I'm working on for a very long time. And I think when you first reached out, I was just sending the final version to the press, but then it takes another, you know, then there's copy editing and proofs and all that wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
So I wasn't quite ready to talk about it. In fact, the thing I wanted most at that time was not to talk about it, as anyone who has ever written a book can surely attest.
It's an odd feeling. You pour your heart and your soul and incredible amounts of time into something, and for a while you just wish it would go away so you could have this thing called life. The offspring we're talking about for everyone is called The Insider's Game: How Elites Make War and Peace. And when I first heard that this was in process from your research, it just seemed like a great extended topic for this podcast, because of the topic of elites. You know, it's so hard to find signal, you know, actual data and reliable analysis of it on this phenomenon against and amongst all the noise about the deep state and the blob. So as I was coming in to record this, I grabbed the copy of the new book on the way in case I wanted to refer to anything in your printed page. And for some reason on my bookshelf, I had it on top of the Harry Potter books. And I thought, well, maybe we should call this, you know, Fantastic Elites and Where to Find Them. Or at least where to find their influence, because that's really what you focused on, is the focus of elites and how this thing, which some people just call the blob or casually dismiss as the deep state or praise as the steady state, what do they actually do when it comes to decisions of war and peace and escalation of conflict?
What spells do they cast?
Ooh, okay, we could just do this whole theme.
There's a lot of politics in Harry Potter, like bureaucratic politics in Harry Potter, and
oh, yeah.
I appreciate it very much as a scholar of bureaucratic politics and elites. So
you've really dug into this. I mean, you've really been looking at elites from multiple directions, but let's go a step back before that even. What got you interested in studying the world and foreign policy decision-making within it, and what path did that take you on to get here?
Well, I have sort of an unusual background. I was in high school kind of torn between history courses that I really loved and science and math. And I ended up majoring in science in college and took a lot of courses that were wonderful. And I worked in a lab and I loved doing scientific research, but I did all of the courses I could that I could fit in around that in diplomatic history or political science. And by the end, I was just very unsure of, like, it was like a fork in the road. And I was finally at a point where I couldn't, you know, I always give students advice that the best thing to do is to make a choice that closes the fewest doors. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a long time. And then you just reach a point where, you know, you got to pick. I took the GRE with the intention of going to grad school in physics. And then I got a fellowship and I got to spend a year at the University of Cambridge doing a master's in IR.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really formative. And it was the year before 9/11. So it was a much more open time in terms of traveling and airport security. And there hadn't been Brexit, among many other differences. And, you know, so it was really quite a formative experience. And decided to apply to grad school and ended up starting my PhD program in political science the week of 9/11.
Wow.
I was in a class that morning. Mm-hmm. And being from New York, it was a really kind of, you know, traumatic experience in many ways. But I have found political science to be a fantastic way to kind of combine my interest in decisions about war and peace, which I think have always fascinated me, and just how, you know, the inner workings of power and how people, and specifically those who lead really powerful countries, make decisions with, you know, increasingly horrific weapons at their disposal. I always thought I would end up doing something related to nuclear weapons because it seemed a natural kind of tie-in. And then I just got really interested in the fact that there was so much talk in the post 9/11 period about why the Iraq war, and we all agree there's this threat, but we are disagreeing. Like, how could reasonable people disagree about the nature of threats and how to address them if all the theory I was getting in my basic international relations PhD classes said they don't disagree about these things? Like, there was no reasonable people disagreeing in the theories. And it just seemed missing this idea of, you know, people have interests and different kinds of beliefs. And that led me to my dissertation topic, which became my first book, Leaders at War. And that took me to presidential archives. The cover of that book has a picture of the three presidents that I looked at in depth in the book, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. But the funny thing about it is there's a fourth president sitting in the church pew in the original picture, and that was Harry Truman. When I went to the libraries, I was always trying to find the pictures of the three of them together. Mm-hmm. But most of the time was funerals, right? And so Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral, there was a guy with a giant cross coming down, like blocking one of their faces. So that wasn't going to work. Kennedy's inauguration, like, they weren't on equal footing. Mm-hmm. But at Sam Rayburn's funeral, they were all sitting in a pew. And they were sitting in a way that perfectly matched the way I coded them in my empirical data. Like, they were in the right order, except for there was Truman on the end. And so I asked the press to just crop Truman out. So this book has Harry Truman in it because I did feel I owed him.
That's right. Wow. I did not expect that meta story. That's amazing.
Well,
so you did archival research, and we've talked to obviously many people who have done that. And I've done some archival research, especially in the presidential libraries as well. How did you find that experience? It can be an acquired taste to be literally flipping through page after page, folder after folder, box after box, hoping to find the right thing. What did you like about it, and what didn't you like?
I'd say the one thing I didn't like was it gave me a lot of back pain. It's actually surprisingly exhausting to be like hunched over. And so the ergonomics, I would say, is the only downside, but the rest of it I really loved. I mean, I think that the system of archives and preserving our records is increasingly, I reflect on it as part of democracy, you know, that I can show up there, and unless it's still classified, and I can even ask them to declassify it. And then, yes, it's very slow, but, you know, there's some things that need to stay classified for longer, et cetera. But mostly, if I asked for it as a citizen or a scholar, they'll give it to me. And that's important and very basic. And I think the last few years have led us to reflect more on that. And I think that's in general a good thing. And understanding our history and going back, correcting, you know, the corrected volume, or the second volume of the U.S. Relations with Iran in the 1950s that the State Department put out. And it's fabulous. And I just, huge shout out to the Foreign Relations of the United States series, without which neither one of these books would have been possible. And the people who run that series are just phenomenal people. And it's kind of a best of the archives for those who don't know. And it's a real, like, it's really where you go first to look at that, and then you can fill in, you know, around it. It's curated, it's edited, and they make choices, but it's an incredible resource. And to me, this is part of democracy, right? Like, just being able to understand how these decisions get made and have a record of it. But then the other thing I love about it is it just gives you a flavor for there was a day, and on that day, somebody might not have had a good breakfast, or somebody was annoyed. Like, the more common thing you find is somebody was thinking about other things unrelated to your topic, right? Yeah. Archives are not organized by, you know, David's dissertation topic or Elizabeth's dissertation topic. They're organized by, well, it depends, right? I mean, someone told me before, the thing you do before you go to an archive is you make sure you talk to people who've been to that archive before. And that's also true of presidential archives. So before I went to the Reagan Library, I asked some people who'd been, and one of the friends of mine that gave me advice said, when you go there, you will physically feel the tension from inside the Reagan administration, like the battles and the bureaucratic knife fighting.
Just because of the way it's organized?
The papers, yes. Yeah. And that's has nothing, this is not in the slightest a comment on the fabulous staff that runs it. But you can just, like, it's impossible to find anything in a sort of linear way. There's just an amazing amount of bureaucratic politics just in the documents. And it's true. You really get a flavor for the climate and incidental stuff. Like, I went and looked at, for my first book, the Kennedy Library pre-presidential records when, you know, from before he was elected. And that stuff, what saved in that era is just like whatever the person running the Boston office, whatever their filing system was. So I look at a bunch of files that are like alpha by subject, and it's like Indochina. I was like, okay, that looks good. And then Kennedy wedding, and out comes a handwritten list of all the wedding presents given to the Kennedys by various senators. Like, what did Nixon get them, and what did, you know, all these names from that era, the senators from that period. So it's just, I mean, how does that not make you smile, right? And or sometimes want to vomit, depending on what it is you find.
That's very true from my experience as well. Both sides, the different organizations between the libraries, not because of anything the National Archives and Records Administration is doing wrong. It's just that's the way that they were organized by the presidency. So in one place, if you're trying to find references to some intelligence meeting at the White House, which I was researching, you go to the National Security Council files because that's where they kept that. In other places, it's an advisor's personal file. Finding the different ways of doing it, thank God for the archivists, because they understand it and they can point you in the right direction, or more likely, as you mentioned, the right 47 directions. And then you pull all the boxes and hope to find it. But the same experience of going through the boxes and even in a limited period of time, trying to avoid getting distracted by things like the wedding gift list or at the Kennedy Library, I'm finding some documents that were the predecessor to the president's daily brief. And I'm looking through some documents related to those and actual copies of the president's intelligence checklist that was given to Kennedy. And right in there is a note from Jackie that she had written to her husband saying something like, Jack, can you please turn the TV down? It's keeping me up. And he had put it apparently as a bookmark inside his intelligence checklist as he was reading it that night. It's hard not to look at that. It's hard not to think about that for a few seconds, even if you have limited time at the facility. There are rabbit holes you're going to go down just because this is history and you're seeing these intimate moments within it.
And I always tell students, like, stop and smell the archival roses, right? Like, there's sort of two images of the arc of archival work. One is you go in and you find the smoking gun, right?
Right.
The smoking gun. And that is, I mean, it's never happened to me. Maybe it's happened to you or others, but there's usually not a smoking gun because you're trying to piece everything together.
Yeah.
And the other is that you have to go in and just vacuum up everything, right? And the process you're describing, like, are the records kept by the advisor or are they kept by the NSC? Like, that's a political choice, right? Mm-hmm. And it reflects where the power is. And just because someone has a title doesn't mean they really knew what was going on.
Yep.
And so you get a flavor for that. And the other sort of thing that's really important is all those documents you read, you're not going to cite more than a tiny fraction in the final product. Mm. But all the things you read along the way inform your understanding of and set the context for, you know, you could read 1,000 letters that JFK, his office sent to constituents about his views on Cuba, which I mean, probably not a thousand, but I read a lot of letters about Cuba policy when he was a senator before he got elected. I think I only cited one or two, but I'm able to say in a footnote, like, this, these two are reflective of several hundred other similar letters, right? And you're able to say that because you put in the work to read, yeah, you know, flip through them all. So I tend to think that as long as you are mindful of time management, that the rabbit holes can actually turn out to be important in unexpected ways. But they also remind you, these are elites with preferences and interpersonal pettiness or, yep, or kindness. And it's a reminder that they're humans, and that to me is an important dimension.
With very rare exceptions. I mean, some of them may be monsters, yeah, or beasts, but the vast majority of people are human beings. You mentioned elites a couple of times there, and it's a good transition into this because we're essentially talking about it now. But put a boundary around it. Who are foreign policy elites writ large? And then, if you will, talk about the specific subsets that you have researched in depth and why they are important to analyze.
Yeah, this is a great question that I think I've answered probably 100 different ways in the 100 times I've talked about this book. There's a lot of different ways you can define elites, and they're sort of depends on the specific context, right? But to me, I was interested in the political side of elites and in the broadest sense. So who can engage in bargaining over a policy, foreign policy, security policy, the people who are involved in and have access to some part of the decision-making apparatus and who have access to crucial information that other people don't have. Doesn't have to be secret, but it's information that is just not readily available, mm-hmm, to the public.
I mean, that could even include things like, you know, prominent foreign policy, national security journalists and editors of newspapers who have private meetings with the president or with other elites because they have some knowledge that is not universally known to the public. So a maximalist definition would be, you know, yourself. It would be people writing and studying these things who have some kind of knowledge beyond a base level knowledge. That's a huge inclusion if you do that.
Yeah, it is a big group. And I think there's this instinct to say, oh, well, I'm not an elite, right? The word elite is just become an epithet, right? I mean, it's used by populists and so forth. So I'll just say two things about that. I do think often you find people will say, but what about X, or what about, you know, this group or that group? In any given decision about the use of military force, a lot of different kinds of elites are going to matter, right? The expert on this country who may or may not be in government, or maybe he's an academic expert who consults or is brought in or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about elites is that this is not a book about how they're better than everybody else, right? In fact, this book is very hard on elites in many ways. Part of why I always joke about, like, don't ask me anything about trade policy or health policy, right? We are all, as humans, busy people, mm-hmm, and we worry about certain things and we don't worry about other things. And so to say someone is a foreign policy elite just means that they devote a lot of their time to thinking about foreign policy. It doesn't make them better or worse. It doesn't make them, you know, superior. It doesn't mean that they necessarily would be that great if you threw them in a think tank, ask them to talk about healthcare, because they, mm-hmm, don't follow those debates. We all kind of specialize in our life. This is very natural. It's the way humans make sense of a complicated world.
Sure.
So to me, this is just reality. And, mm-hmm, I'm sort of a small R realist, in the sense of, like, I'm very realistic about this. Elites are fallible. They make good decisions and bad decisions. And the trick is just to, like, understand that process so we can try to improve it, not demonize and get rid of them, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do think that the group is large. The subset that I focus on in this book, I mean, what I came back to is, like, every use of force is going to have a lot of different kinds of elites involved. But in any use of force, all uses of military force or decisions about military force, you'll have three groups that are pretty much always involved. One is the military, like the top military, mm-hmm, leadership, because they will always be asked for options even if force doesn't get used. So you got to include the military because they're always there. Members of Congress, or more generally, you know, legislators in other countries, because whether or not they're consulted, the shadow of their potential constraint is there in some form in right. every one of these decisions. And finally, the president's inner circle of advisors and cabinet officials. And that, I think, can include intelligence. You know, it's not just like the formal cabinet. Mm-hmm. And it often includes like the deputies and people kind of like where the policy really gets made day to day. And I think you start there and then you can say, okay, in this use of force, there was this country specific thing and this other group that came in. But that to me was the starting place.
Yeah.
We political scientists get paid to traffic in gross oversimplifications, right? That's the job description.
There it is. Well, it's interesting, I think, inherently, just because the role of advisors and experts, while studied in, you know, a lot of character studies, biographies, the systematic study of it in the same way as so many other things in political science, like voting behavior, I think it's underdone. But it's also interesting in contrast with, I guess, either the dominant theory out there or at least a prominent theory out there, which does get through to the public also, that it's about the elected leader and, in a democracy, the public. And the elected leader is going to respond to signals from the public and give signals to the public. And the elites are kind of lost in there. Yes, you may have some people acknowledge that there's a mediating effect of information, just as the media will mediate information to and from the public, that advisors might. But most of the time, you don't get that in the kind of the basic model, maybe the elementary school model of how foreign policy is made in a democracy. Maybe somebody thinks to mention Congress, but usually it's about the elected leaders who represent the will of the people and are then held accountable to the people. But they leave the elites out of it so much. And I think if I can read into your overall project here, it's to kind of bring the elites back in.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of summarizing it. I wish I'd called you when I was struggling to reframe the introduction, 4 years ago or something. This is a book that, you know, you mentioned at the very top, offspring, and I had two others, offspring, like two babies, and then the 2016 election, which was kind of about elites. And so it wasn't as though on the day after the election, I could just go back to my theory chapter. I mean, that took a while to kind of think through. And then the pandemic, right? So there was this has been quite a while, but I think you've captured it, right? I call it the kind of faithful intermediaries model, as the foil for my argument. This idea, as you put it, that there's the voters, they elect politicians, mm-hmm. and for better or for worse, the elites are basically channeling the public will and held accountable when they stray from it. And there's variants of that, but that's sort of the dominant, you know, voters are really front and center. But it became pretty clear to me, both in kind of interacting on a daily basis with my colleagues who study American political voting behavior and many other aspects of American politics, that kind of scorecard voting, this idea that what we do when we go and vote is to hold our leaders accountable, like just for the foreign policy, which is an oversimplification even of the other theories. But clearly that's one ingredient among many.
Right. And that's definitely a funny thing I've had. I'm a national security foreign policy junkie like you. I understand that there is healthcare policy and trade policy and agricultural policy, and these things matter immensely, much more so than I give them credit for on a daily basis. So all of that is there. But I focus on foreign policy stuff. That doesn't mean the American people as a whole do. And if you look back at every presidential election and just limit it to that, much less congressional elections, it's really hard to find all but a few exceptions when foreign policy was one of the major issues at stake. There are some, but they're definitely in the minority. But that doesn't mean that it's not important to study. Obviously, there's war and peace. There's escalation of conflict. There's de-escalation and withdrawal decisions that are made that literally affect millions of lives and, with their implications, billions of lives. So we have to look at it, even if the American people don't look at it in elections. And one way of doing that is by understanding better all of the mechanisms that go on. We'll not delve any deeper into the theory part at this point, simply because, you know, general audiences, you know, they love the theory and they're going to buy the book to get all that rich, meaty lore in the theory. But your thesis is that elites actually do have an independent effect from just mediating, and that they're actually different in a general sense between historical Republican and Democratic administrations.
Sure. Well, for a while, I was very focused on, well, it couldn't be that the voters are not the main constraint because they have this one blunt tool they only get to use for every 4 years. And I was just trying to kind of demonstrate that there are all these other tools that elites have. And then I began to think, okay, but so like, what does this really add up to? Does it add up to more war or less war? Because in the end, if it's just about the process and you get to the same answer, then there's no reason to supplant or add more variables to the older models that are basically the leader and the voter. So, and I take that seriously. I mean, I think we, in political science, we want to have a simple, parsimonious explanation. So you have to justify why you're adding all these other things. And after a while, I began to see a pattern, which is that the image of the Democratic Party, for better and for worse, since the Truman years, has been of the stereotype of kind of the weaker on national security, right? Republicans have really owned the national security as an issue. And there's just a wealth of empirical evidence that the American public perceives them as the party of national security. Again, you know, I don't make the rules. This is just, for better or for worse, the empirical reality, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, if you look at the history of American foreign policy and national security, Democrats have fought a lot of wars or extended wars they inherited, right? There, this is not a party that has shied away from using military force. Hmm. And that struck me as very strange, right? That we do have really different party images. And yet in the end, we have very similar party behavior. And so there's a lot of different ways you can get to that. Could be that the Republicans are constantly doing the Nixon to China move, right? That they're actually not fighting as many wars as you might expect. But the more I looked at it, the more I sort of saw Republicans were essentially unchained when they wanted to be initiating the use of military force. Usually Republicans kind of get constrained at the end after they're already in, but they're not particularly inhibited from fighting wars. You don't often see, like, I can't fight this war because I will be called a warmonger. I mean, it's nice to sort of tone that down, but Republicans don't seem to be particularly inhibited by that. Whereas Democrats seem to be backed into fighting sometimes because of this like fear that they're going to be tarred as the wimpy doves, right? And so the other way you can get to sort of convergence is for Democrats to kind of fight more wars than you'd expect, right? Mm-hmm. And I sort of call that a hawkish bias, and it really comes primarily from the Democrats. And so it's really a very simple story in some sense. There's just like some extra wars from the Democratic side that you wouldn't necessarily have expected because the doves are fighting in order to preserve their political capital on other fronts. I call that the dove's curse, this idea like, I'll just fight this little war so I can neutralize the issue and pass healthcare or pass the Great Society or what have you. That's what I call an agenda cost. Like sometimes Democrats just do this because they have a bigger agenda than do Republicans, for whom national security is kind of the thing.
But there is a parallel on the Republican side, right? The Hawks, what, misadventures of Hawks?
Hawks misadventures, just, yes.
Walk through that as the parallel.
So part of why I theorize that it's the Democrats moving to the hawkish direction that induces the hawkish bias, just to take a step back, if we were in the faithful intermediaries model, you'd expect that these effects would cancel out, right? Because it is true, we have a lot of evidence from scholars like Jessica Weeks and Michaela Mates and Ken Schultz that there are incentives to act against type. So hawks do have the advantage when they want to go to China, when they want to do a peace initiative, etc. They are just more trusted and they get credit for trying. But in those arguments, there's not really a place for asymmetry there, right? Doves are maybe like get some credit for trying when they fight, and hawks get some credit for making peace, and it all just washes out. In this case, you got the not just the Democrats kind of moving into the more hawkish territory, but also the hawks don't actually have as strong an incentive to go against type. So in other words, if you want to be yourself, like if the hawks want to be hawkish, they can do that more easily because this is the issue they own. They can more easily get people on board. I think Iraq is a really good example of this. We could talk about the Democrats in Congress who, you know, for relatively low procedural price, gave Bush a lot of support that allowed him to say it was bipartisan. So before the war starts, the hawks can more easily evade the constraints and be themselves. Whereas the doves, it's more costly for them to just be dovish.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always think of like the West Wing, let Bartlett be Bartlett, right? Mm-hmm. If you want the doves to be doves, they have to choose to absorb those political costs.
Yeah. One of the real tough issues here, and thinking about it methodologically, like, you know, the old, you know, PhD in international relations that I used to be, I find it methodologically really hard to get an answer to this question. So I'm going to ask it of you because you're way, way better at this.
I definitely know the trick, the whole trick of like, I can't answer this question, so I'll ask the next person.
That's right.
You know, that's what we professors do all day long.
There you go. Well, the buck stops with you because I'm passing it to you here and no one else is on the conversation. So part of the issue there is you talk about this in terms of trying to buy support from elites. And you have a lot of conversation about what price does a president pay, you know, on this and on that, the, you know, agenda costs, side payments, things of that sort. But sometimes, even to cynics, sometimes it is about the substance. Sometimes a Democrat in Congress can look at the information that she has on, let's say, the Iraq war and say, yeah, I think Saddam Hussein is evil and I can go along with it. Regardless of party, regardless of domestic agenda, regardless of whether the president is of the same party, there actually can be substantive arguments for one intervention or another. And I just find that methodologically really, really hard to tease out. Like how do you account for the fact that there's a difference between escalation in Korea, escalation in Vietnam, decision to intervene in Lebanon or not in Somalia or Haiti? How do you actually separate out someone's true assessment of the wisdom of this policy and whether they themselves understand their own rational decision on that front? So I put that to you, it may be unanswerable, but I put that to you because people who aren't methodologists who look at this say, well, yeah, sure, you know, maybe even then when it wasn't quite as polarized, maybe even then you had Democrats who just didn't want to do what a Republican said on foreign policy. But sometimes they would give briefings, they would have conversations, maybe the members would talk to constituents, and they actually would agree on the substance. And it wasn't about getting something out of the president in order to support the policy.
So I'm going to do the other trick, which is to say, this is a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
And I think it's really an interesting way into thinking about the idea of like, what does it mean to own an issue and be trusted on an issue, right? Mm-hmm. So when you think about dovish parties, not all Democrats are doves, but they are all tarred with the dovish label because that's the brand that's sort of more associated with Democrats. You can imagine a scenario where a dovish leader really believes that peace is the right policy or staying out of a conflict is totally the right policy for substantive reasons. But the public associates that president with dovishness, and therefore there's a credibility gap. How can that president convince the public that it is really because the president's looked at all the evidence and so forth, rather than just this president is dovish and is just like willfully sticking to the dovish instincts, right? That's what it means to have a credibility deficit on an issue. There is no way to tell. And that doesn't happen to hawks to the same degree, right?
Yeah.
And that credibility gap is why Democratic presidents put Republicans in positions like Secretary of Defense, because they want to try to close that gap. Mm-hmm. And it's never gone in the other direction. Republicans appointing Democrats.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that Republicans are empirically better at foreign policy. These are party brands that are quite sticky, and it puzzles me why they've lasted so long. But again, I don't make the rules, right?
Separate question there, but that's a fascinating one because, we can think of counterexamples pretty easily, and yet the type and the perception of type remains.
Yeah, that may be the next, that's a spinoff that I'm interested in thinking about.
Yeah. But
anyhow, I think the other way of coming at your question is I do think we can and have not previously separated the personal, political, career motivations that elites have from sincere beliefs. So I certainly think there are sincere beliefs. I mean, one early draft of this, somebody said, my goodness, this book is cynical, right? And it is, it's very cynical. There's not a lot of deliberation, substantive views. And I think that's probably a weakness, right? I mean, there's more substantive debate and people care about these things. I mean, my first book had more of that and was much less cynical in many ways. But what's been missing is in our treatment of elites is their political motivations, their career motivations. And so the problem with that is you're left with either elites only care about substance and policy. And so the expectation is, well, if they don't like it, they should resign in protest. Or at the other extreme, they're entirely motivated by political motivations or career motivations, promotions, you know, in the military and so forth. And they have no ability to make any judgments except on that, right? It's all they're all out for themselves. Populists like to paint them that way. And the reality, again, as a small r, like just being realistic about it, obviously the answer must be in between. And I do think we can tease some of that out. We can find out who had sincere misgivings, but supported a war anyway, and observe that process and theorize that process. Who is more likely to feel the political heat for sticking to their guns and airing misgivings?
Yeah. And that does actually match with real experience. You know, in my experience in the government, in some of these conversations at the White House, National Security Council, and elsewhere, there are the top-level advisors, not me, but the briefing, the top-level advisors who are interacting with the president every day on decisions of war and escalation. Some of them were clearly true believers, either true believers in the president and his decision-making, and it's always been a his up to this point, but his decision-making, or true believers in the actual policy independent of the president doing it. But then there are others who are more, I don't know what to call them, bureaucratic players, if you will, or who definitely were looking for more, okay, so how does this affect what I really do care about? And it's all transactional. And of course, that itself varies between administrations based on the leadership cues from the president. Some recent presidents have been much more transactional than others. But all of those dynamics come into play. And I guess the big picture I take away from that, kind of away from the implications for international relations theory, but to understanding how foreign policy is made in this country, is it really debunks the idea that there is this kind of omnidirectional blob, or, you know, the
or
elite
unidirectional blob that has one uniform set
that's
of preferences,
right? Yeah, that the deep state is pushing for X, when in fact anybody who goes into enough meetings, and not just principals committee and deputies, but all the working level meetings that lead up to these foreign policy decisions, as a taxpayer, you'd either be proud that it is not this single-minded evil deep state pushing in one direction, trying to manipulate presidents to do what they want. And that's a good thing. Or you'd be horrified as a taxpayer that all of this money is going into these people who are arguing at every level about what the best way of doing it is. But it's certainly not a unified conspiratorial deep state. And that becomes clear, obviously, in experience, people who have worked it, but also through the research and looking at these decisions from, you know, Korea and Truman's decision-making to Vietnam and Lyndon Johnson up to the modern day. Talk a little bit, we won't go into all those cases in depth, but talk a little bit why you chose the major case studies you did. And then we'll highlight one as an example.
So I was looking for cases that I could sink my teeth into, right? I mean, it's very hard to do the recent cases in much depth.
True.
I also wanted, you know, I wanted to be able to say, this is not a product of polarization. This isn't a product of low salience. There was when back in the decade I started this project, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of talk of like a new Cold War, and foreign policy was less salient for a couple of decades. I mean, we had 9/11, of course, but it's just a bit different in the way, you know, not great power competition, the way we sort of routinely talk about it now. And so I wanted to show that this was not a post-Cold War phenomenon. So I wanted to have, you know, during the Cold War and post-Cold War, and then I also wanted Republicans and Democrats, because I think also, you know, another dynamic that your previous question suggests is like, okay, well, so what does it matter if the Democrat is the one who escalates the war, or if it's a Republican? Like, in the end, if there's a hawkish bias, like, why do we care? And I do think that there actually are dynamics, and I get into this in the theory, that are really different between the parties. And it does matter that it's Truman who's in power and dealing with MacArthur in the Korean War, and seeking Republican cover after, you know, all the McCarthyite attacks on China policy and Taiwan and so forth. That has real implications for the course of the war, civil-military relations that lead up to the MacArthur firing, Truman's own domestic agenda, the fact that he had a huge domestic agenda that he was quite worried about, but also wanted to do rearmament in Europe, which was a highly politically controversial thing at the time. And it, all these things, and also Taiwan policy unexpectedly, right? There's a huge part of the Korea story that's really about the origins of the commitment to Taiwan, very much against Truman's own instincts and preferences, all done to kind of appease the Republican China lobby, as it was then called. And I think you can imagine a Republican being in power when the North Koreans invaded South Korea, the incentives would have been different. And this is a book about taking seriously, you know, elites are not perfect. They're, in fact, they make terrible decisions a lot of the time. But it's also the bad decisions can be bad in very different ways, echoing Tolstoy, right? You know, every unhappy family is unhappy. You could have this kind of bad decision and not this other kind of bad decision. And we want to understand the political incentives that drove these presidents and not sweep them under the rug, because if we are trying to improve policy and our understanding of how policy gets made, a broad brush demonization of everybody who makes these decisions is not going to get us very far.
Yeah. So you mentioned Truman and Korea there. You looked at Johnson and Vietnam, right? You examined Reagan and the Lebanon intervention for a Republican case, and then kind of a mixed case, but focusing primarily on the decision to surge in Iraq from George W. Bush, followed by the presidents who succeeded him and decisions on Afghanistan. So you cover, temporally, you cover quite a range. You have a balance of Democratic and Republican stories. Obviously, major wars and less major wars are involved in both. You leave out a lot because you can't study everything. But even if you did include everything, we're still talking about, we're not doing massive data sets here, right? No. You've only got a handful of presidents in the modern era to look at, and you've only got...
It probably would fit in two or three of those church pews, right?
Yeah, that would be a heck of a picture.
Yeah,
I don't think we've ever had that many presidents because of, you know, things like time. We've never had that many presidents in one picture, but, you know, you could do a painting of them all playing poker together. Yeah. That would work.
There's a pretty good one, actually, of Nixon's funeral of the five. There's usually
you got
like
five
or
six,
five.
Right?
Yeah.
You're not going to do much more than that, although, well, this could be a whole other conversation, and I'm sure it will be at some point on this podcast. But to me, even if you look at all decisions of war or peace or escalation above a certain threshold, and you decide what that is, you're still talking about a number of finite cases. And the separation effects, when you have so many potential variables, it's hard to come up with like a universal law. So if I characterize your work right, you're not looking to come up with that. You're not looking to say all Democrats will always do this and elites will always make this happen. You're talking about trends. You're talking about tendencies, and with a mind towards pointing out that, yes, the tendencies are enough that we can say with some confidence that elites actually do matter. Elites do affect these decisions in a way that has been underappreciated before.
Yes. And I think a couple of examples illustrate this dynamic. And it gets back to this really nice question you posed earlier about, like, how do we separate the sincere motives from the, I sometimes think of them as the icky motives, like the unseemly motives. But I think we should move away from that because this is how foreign policy decisions get made. Democracy is about making deals with people who weight issues differently from you, right? Or care about things in a different way. And anyhow, that's another soapbox. But, you know, but I think of it sometimes as the sort of like icky stuff that people don't always want to stay into the dictaphone. And so that's one reason to study Lyndon Johnson is always because he said it all in the dictaphone.
It's there.
In sometimes not very family friendly language. If you want to curse in class, teach Lyndon Johnson. That's my advice for fellow professors. Anyhow, I digress. A different way of putting that question would be, does it matter if somebody supported the war for political reasons or if they supported it for sincere reasons? And I think the answer is yes. And the reason is illustrated by a lot of the actions that you would see in the lead up to the Iraq War. So not every Democrat voted to authorize the use of military force in Iraq. And those who did had a variety of motives. Some of them may have been sincerely hawkish. Maybe they had some misgivings, but they thought, you know, we've got to take a stand. Some of them were running for president and truly believe this is the right side of the issue to be on. And they looked at what happened to Sam Nunn in 1991 when he opposed the
first Gulf War.
First Gulf War and said, this is not the winning side. This is going to be a cakewalk. So they're telling me. And I don't, you know, being on the wrong side will be a political loser for my campaign. Others were pressured, you know, think of like that horrible ad that was run by the Chambliss campaign against Max Cleland and so forth, even after he'd voted for the authorization, attacking him as a veteran who'd lost limbs in Vietnam as being weak. And, you know, so it could be that you're under threat, or it could be you just think like, maybe I don't really need this war or don't think it's a good idea. But if I vote for it, it just neutralizes this issue and my party can do the things I really care about. Like, I just am not one of those people who thinks deeply about this. I think deeply about healthcare or some other agricultural policy. And I think it really matters because for a Republican president, all those motives make it easier to get that bipartisan support. Not full bipartisan support, but the price of peeling off a few doves to let the hawk be the hawk is lower than the price the dove would have to pay to get hawks to say, okay, it's all right to stay out of this war so that the dove can be a dove. I mean, sometimes doves decide to just absorb the cost. I think Joe Biden did that in Afghanistan by and large, so staying the course even after, you know, it would be easy, politically easy to imagine he decides to leave a force at the Kabul airport or keep Bagram Air Base in response to events, right? That would have been the politically easier path in many ways. And he just absorbed the costs and came out and said, I am absorbing the costs. I mean, he didn't make any bones about it. And I'd say Obama's decision not to fight in Syria was another one. But I think the fact that it's cheaper for hawks enables these misadventures that you would not get otherwise. And that's a tendency. Hawks sometimes make very good decisions or prudent decisions, very good selective decisions, but it's a built-in bias. And the flip side of that is what happens after the war starts is also very important. So in the Vietnam War, you had these just never-ending incremental increases until you reach the point of like 500,000 troops in Vietnam. I mean, to me, this is just mind-boggling. Every time I teach and I show the charts, it's like either side of the peak in 1968, you still have like 400,000 people and just a level of military force sustained over time that I don't think most Americans remember experiencing if they're of a certain generation, you know, they didn't live through it. And I just, the Democratic presidents who made those decisions, primarily Johnson, they knew it wasn't going to work. This is the Galvin Betts, the system worked, the irony of Vietnam, the system worked, right? They knew, their eyes were wide open. They were not after victory. They were after not losing. And Republicans have an incentive to come to some kind of decisive outcome. That's why Reagan has an easy time getting into Lebanon, But then, you know, once you're in as a hawk, that's your issue and you got to perform. Like, you don't get the participation trophy that the Democrats get for fighting.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of evidence that Democrats are less punished for these kind of inconclusive wars. That's what I mean by kind of like the participation trophy. You get the credit for trying.
Yeah.
So you see Republicans either cutting their losses or escalating to seek something they can call a victory, which is what happens in the surge. And if you imagine a Democratic president inheriting, like maybe John Kerry inherits the Iraq War in 2004 in the universe where he wins that election, you would not expect the same decision making from a Democrat or a Republican. So I do think that it really does matter the motivations and the political incentives for the tendencies you expect. So we expect inconclusive, drawn out wars from Democrats, and we expect kind of a two different, you know, extremes. Republicans will either kind of cut their losses or escalate for victory. And again, that's not a law. We're not dealing with a huge number of cases, but it's a built-in tendency, I think, that has actually been borne out since 1945.
Yeah. And hearing you talk through it that way, it occurs to me that, and this is going to be the thing that you never want to hear, and I shouldn't say, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is I think there's an extra step in there that at least helps me understand it more, which is it's not that a Democratic president is more dovish. It's that a Democratic president is perceived as more dovish.
Absolutely.
And
that's right.
I discovered this when I introduced perceptions into my whole theory for the academic project I was working on for my dissertation that never got to the book point, was once you introduce perceptions, it gets really thorny because it's insanely difficult to accurately measure and sometimes even describe perceptions, but it's the perception of dovishness. So another counterfactual that I've had healthy arguments with people about have to do with, you know, going into Iraq based on, number one, the WMD evidence or presumed evidence that was available at the time, not what was known later, but what was being assessed at the time. Number two, the long shadow of 9/11 and the different threshold for taking on threats from outside the United States that could affect the United States. And then third, the increasing information that was coming out about the brutality of Saddam's regime. If Al Gore were president, so the hypothetical that historians hate, but if Al Gore were president, the model, if you just look at party ID, would say, well, Gore being more dovish would have very different issues here. But the way I've heard you describe it, it's more that I think, all things being equal, and you can never play this out, so we will not be able to test it, but Al Gore in the same situation as George W. Bush very well might have made the same choice based on the information that was available, based on being vice president for 8 years, seeing scary intelligence every single working day, not being the most dovish member of the Democratic Party by any means. But the fact that he was perceived as, because he's a Democrat, perceived as having that situation, that elite dynamic you described might have played out somewhat differently, but not in a way that led to a lack of an Iraq intervention. In fact, some of the dynamic you point out is that this might have been a dove's curse, that Gore might, by being perceived as more dovish, might have had just as much, if not more, incentive to invade Iraq as George W. Bush did.
Wow, I've engaged in the, like, what would Al Gore have done debate. Yeah. Just the other day, I was trying to explain to one of my kids, like, the concept of the hanging chad and, like, the physical piece of paper hanging by, you know, a thread.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that any of this would not be digital is just completely foreign to them. I do think that the perceptions thing is very important. And I made a shift kind of towards the end of editing to be careful to say not dovish leaders, but leaders from dovish parties, because the whole point is parties contain multitudes and both parties contain hawks and doves or more restrained actors. Mm-hmm. And it's that range that actually makes the argument work, because if Democrats were entirely dovish, then there would be no uncertainty, right? That you need that uncertainty. But if you are a truly hawkish Democrat, you're still tarred with the label, right? And actually, of all the perception stuff, this is the easiest one because we got polling data. Like the perception is there, and it doesn't move. I have a graph in the book of just basic, like, which party do you trust? And the Democrats never crack 50%. They only tie once with the Republican Party for at least equal at the moment of Iraq, sort of like Nader in 2006. And I mean, I just find that astounding in many ways, and not even because of favoring one party or the other, just because it's so stable, given, you know, good things and bad things that have happened under both parties. So I think the perception is real and it's important, and it's definitely a major factor. If you ask a question like, would Al Gore have invaded Iraq? One of the arguments about the Iraq war that I take really seriously is this idea that Afghanistan wasn't enough and we were looking for something else. Right. That said, you know, Johnson inherited Vietnam, so it was already on his agenda. Korea was put on Truman's agenda by the North Korean invasion.
Yeah.
So you have to ask yourself, like, would Al Gore have come up with the idea to invade Iraq? Like, would that have made it on his agenda? I could imagine he would feel pressure to do more in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Right. There's no question. I think any president would have attacked Afghanistan, right? They harbored the terrorists. There are so many people inside the Bush administration who from the very beginning tried to connect 9/11 and Iraq in ways that seemed odd even to people at the time, that I don't know that that connection would have been made by a Gore administration. Now, there are arguments on the other side of that, right? That the neoconservatives had been very comfortable floating between parties, and maybe some of them would have been inside of a Democratic Al Gore administration. They had supported a lot of the Clinton era, or some of them at least had supported the Clinton era humanitarian interventions. Maybe they would have put pressure in the direction of Iraq. But you can imagine Gore would have been backed into something. I think that my theory does predict that. I don't know that it would have been invading without immediate provocation.
Yeah, it's so hard to say. I mean, the thing that's lost over the last 20 years, I think, when you talk to, you know, when I talk to students that I've taught about the Iraq invasion, there's some perspective that's lost that I think does touch on this, which is Iraq was not invaded, you know, on a whim. It wasn't that, you know, quote, without provocation, at least in the minds of those doing it. That is, it was not that Iraq and Mauritania were equal. The whole issue of the weapons inspections and what Iraq was doing to what specifically Saddam Hussein was doing to maintain the image in the minds of the world, but particularly looking at Iran, of, well, maybe we do have WMD. You know, we don't want you to think that we don't have WMD, because guess what? We got a big bad neighbor next to us that we could have a really big bad war with again. So we're willing to, you know, gamble that the United States isn't going to push it too far if we continue to play a little tricky on that. Mauritania wasn't doing that. Iraq was doing that. And Al Gore had been through years and years, and with President Clinton, decisions to take military action against Iraq for some of its activities in violating UN resolutions. That dynamic was escalating. So there was a provocation, if you will. Now, would that provocation have been enough? Your argument, I think, about the Hawk's misadventures versus the Dove's curse is that being perceived as a Dove because of his Democratic Party affiliation might have actually brought Gore along to that kind of intervention. But like you said, we can't tell for sure. But the fact that your research has led us to have these conversations with more depth and nuance about the role of elites is great, because it gets us away from just those quick hit assumptions and stereotypes that we would have otherwise.
Yeah. And I think, would Al Gore have been nudged for political, or felt backed into a corner for political reasons? I think that's highly plausible, even though I think he was more hawkish. You know, I always play for my students the 2000 debates where the clips from where it's like Al Gore's like, we got to go into Haiti and East Timor. And Bush is like, what are we doing this for? This is not right. We should be not telling other countries what to do. And it's jaw dropping for my students. The only thing they know about Bush is everything that happened after. Right.
That's right. Well, one other thing in that kind of popular perception thing that I want to get your take on is, how elites not are are thrown around as a pejorative, but, you know, by politicians. That's happened since, you know, the founding of the Republic or shortly thereafter. But more about pop cultural representations, because there are some films and TV shows that do portray presidential discussions with senior advisors, members of Congress, bargaining, trade-offs. You already mentioned The West Wing, which does this in a number of different scenarios. A lot of them get it wrong, and a lot of them get it wrong in comically bad ways, where the senior advisors are either going rogue, doing something to either create immense wealth for themselves, or because they have a maniacal streak, or they're just devious. And what you've discovered is, yes, elites are devious sometimes. Sometimes they are trying to get side payoffs and they're trying to get their agenda across. But it's different than the perception of these elites that are either galactically stupid or horribly evil in pursuing their own agendas at the expense of national security itself.
Or they're saints. I think that's the other
there
one,
are some
right?
Of those,
like
right?
They're the hero types who sacrifice everything and, you know, are willing to speak out at any moment.
Right.
And I think they're all, those are all kind of caricatures, all three of them.
What right? representations of foreign policy elites have you seen in movies and TV that you stand up and take notice?
I recently rewatched The Hunt for Red October.
Oh, yes.
And that was an experience in many ways. But this is the classic problem of international relations. Like, this guy's going to pull this boat up to the coast of the U.S. And how is the U.S. going to know if he's there with good intentions or bad intentions? And what the U.S. does in response is going to be extremely important. And there's this great line where, you know, Sean Connery says, you know, the problem isn't the Russians chasing us, it's the Americans. Like, what if we get a buckaroo, a cowboy? And that to me is like, just elites come in all shapes and sizes. Am I going to encounter a sub commander who's been hunting me all his life and is just going to be thrilled to send a torpedo to blow me up? Or am I going to get Jack Ryan? And I do like that Ryan is kind of portrayed as a bit of, you know, he pukes on the plane over. He has fears.
Yeah, Jack Ryan really is a stereotype himself, right? He's portrayed as the analyst thrown into the operational environment.
Yes, but he also has flaws, right? He's not particularly he's not James Bond.
Totally.
Definitely not James Bond. And so I think that one, and the other one would be The Diplomat, which I think is...
Oh, Kerry Russell. Yeah,
Kerry Russell. And I mean, as someone who is... anyone who knows me that's listening to this podcast is probably vigorously shaking their head when I say I spill stuff on myself all the time when I eat. So one of my favorite parts of that is when she refuses to wear some color, I can't remember which. Mm-hmm. And of course, then she spills yogurt on herself right before she walks into the Oval Office. And it's just a reminder that these are just humans and they they spill stuff on themselves. And more generally, they have careers and she could easily have been a caricature of like the perfect smart woman who comes in and fixes everything.
Yep.
Or the bumbling, like she doesn't know what she's doing. Mm-hmm. But part of the point is that she's a smart person, very well intentioned, who does have her own personal problems that affect her choices and preferences.
Yeah. It's remarkable. I've really enjoyed it for some of the reasons you've highlighted that, you know, you can watch it as someone who's, you know, you work at the State Department, you're around the environment overseas in embassies. You can roll your eyes at parts of it because it's over the top, but guess what? It's entertainment. And as parody of some of those things, it's not bad. And yet the human side actually works, which is the dynamics that do happen between tandem couples, married couples who are both in the business, and then office politics, as well as office relationships, all that combined with, no kidding, national security crises. That mix of all of that is done about as well as I've seen in any fictional representation.
And there's plenty, without giving away, you know, there's plenty of office politics within the State Department, like going, she tries to make an end run around the communications of the intel folks in her embassy and gets caught, and that's a kind of come to Jesus moment with her intel folks.
Yeah.
But then also the plot itself involves the plain vanilla, really cynical politics. And yep. I'll just leave it there because yeah. for those who haven't seen it.
Yeah. So we have a double thumbs up for the yes, diplomat.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think also it sends up the glamour part of it. Mm-hmm. I've written with Jim Goldgar about this. Mm-hmm. It's yep. boring in a good way. Mm-hmm. Like capital B boring. It's slow, eat your spinach kind of diplomacy. And she clearly gets that and disdains the drama, the please right. dress nicely and do spreads in Vogue. And I think that's actually pretty effective.
It highlights that part. And I do like that better than the other side, which is like most fiction does, you know, it represents the caricatures. It represents the extreme versions. So you don't see a lot of people who are there in the embassy or when they have the Washington scenes who are kind of the people who really believe in the mission. They're doing their best. They're working hard and they don't have some personality quirk or dysfunctional relationship. And so it does bias our view of it that everyone in the national security community is either exciting or dramatic or something when there's a whole lot of people who are doing their jobs and serving the system and preparing things and they get relatively less coverage. But that's a quibble compared to so many of the things that are done pretty well in that
way. Yeah. I think any principal would probably tell you that they're the people who make the thing run because without their work,
yeah.
you know, all that spade work, then for the principal to come in and do the signing ceremony, that doesn't happen without the spade work that all the other folks do.
What did you think, if you've seen it or seen glimpses of it, what did you think of her show before that, The Americans, which was largely, you know, an operational spy drama, but it did end up talking in various places about foreign policy decision making, about the officials they were trying to get insight onto the cabinet deliberations of the Reagan White House and things like that.
Yeah, the bugging of Caspar Weinberger's house.
Yeah.
The other one that I loved from that show was the episode where they really believe after Reagan is shot that like there's been a coup from right. Al Haig, and you know, it's just
right. Yeah, perceptions yeah. again, right?
Yeah, that was very a lot of chuckling over that one in our house.
Yeah, because there's some portrayals of what I would call mid-level, although they're probably senior level, yeah. but mid-level bureaucrats at CIA and State Department in that show that most other places don't get into. They're always focused on the president in the room during a crisis and the Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs trying to push them to do something. But it's not about, here's the person who's running the Afghan task force and they have information that's useful to us.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think The Americans puts another perspective on it, which is that you're seeing it from the adversary's perspective.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's a reminder that much as we like to present, I mean, foreign policy and diplomacy is often about packaging and mm-hmm. selling a story. And yeah. I mean, even if you go back to Hunt for Red October, it's about I'm selling the story of defection. And there's other people, yeah. the Soviet ambassador is whispering in the national security advisor's ear that no, it's actually that the sub is there so it can pull up to the coast and fire, you know, do a first strike missile launch.
Yeah.
But you don't have control over how those, like signaling is hard. And
yeah.
Al Haig standing up there and saying, I'm in charge, actually seems to feed the notion that this is really kind of a coup. And you're dealing with an adversary that has a set of historical understandings and biases and preferences of its own. And I mean, I always found it really interesting from that perspective.
Yeah. Right on.
Also hard to watch in some ways, which is why I didn't always watch it.
Yes.
Because of the kids, like the dynamic of like, these are people with families and even the adversary spies have family and
yeah.
are torn in some ways, you know, I found that hard, important, but also just as a parent of young kids at that time, like
I'm with you. I watched it and it was difficult at times for that reason. And in so many deep dives on The Americans that have been had, they rarely talk about the fact that it sometimes you can go episode after episode, maybe half a dozen episodes and running around doing this, going out at night, doing this. And you don't even see the kids, nor do they mention the kids. And yet they'd end up building a story that revolves around the children very much and how they care about the children. And those two don't always come across well. But again, I'm not the one trying to make high quality television. So right. it's easy for me to criticize.
Well, one of the other ones that I always show in class is 13 Days,
yep.
Which is actually very faithful to the book. I mean, one way to make an accurate representation is to have the dictaphone running and then take the transcripts and turn it into a movie script. And it is pretty accurate. And I also point out to my students, like, that the telephone operators are the only women you really see in that movie, right? I mean, the Situation Room looks different today.
It's not a documentary, but it's pretty close. I mean,
it's about as close as you can get. Yeah. But the thing that they do, which I have no problem with, as you say, like, mm-hmm. they're making entertainment. They take the character of Kenneth O'Donnell. Mm-hmm. He was a real person. He was like the Kennedy version of, like, Charlie from The West Wing, right?
Yeah.
The bag man, and they tell the story through his eyes. And I don't have any problem with the narrative device of, but they give Kevin Costner this accent that is just like a Boston accent that is, it's a bit, that's my
distracting. Well, we're human beings too, and we're allowed to be petty about things like that.
Yes.
It's not even petty, actually, because I think it's a legitimate distraction, at least for me it was.
Yeah. But some of those lines that, like, when Curtis LeMay is saying, you know, you're in a real fix, Mr. President, political fix, like the people aren't going to. And Kennedy turns to him and says, like, well, if you haven't noticed, you're in it, too. Mm-hmm. I didn't really believe it until I went and looked at the transcripts, and, like,
there it is.
It's one of the most dramatic moments in the movie, and it's for real.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
One thing I can't let you go without bringing up is everything we've talked about and the way that elite influence manifests itself slightly differently for perceived doves and perceived hawks. The fact that our shifting political landscape right now could be affecting this, not negating it, but affecting it, in that in a hyper-polarized age, dovish presidents or presidents perceived as being from a dovish background don't have the same way of, quote, buying support when people will knee-jerk reflexively not support them no matter what, and vice versa, that hawks don't feel the need to justify things in the same way. You didn't fully investigate this because you were writing this as some of this, and we're in the midst of the shift. We still don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but it certainly seems that some of the traditional Democrat, Republican, national security, bargaining, trade-off structures are changing as we're speaking. And yet the dynamics about elites influencing decisions, I mean, that's still going to be there in one form or another. So talk through your thinking on that. Obviously, you know, you finished putting the copy into the book many, many, many months ago. But just in the last few weeks and months, as you've seen this continue, what are your perceptions now on how polarization affects some of these dynamics of elite influence on war and peace decision-making?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I talk a little bit about it in the intro and the conclusion. And, you know, the optimistic note that you come around to is if the dove's curse, I mean, this book is largely a story of, like, what happened to both the large D and the small D democratic constraints. Mm-hmm. And you realize how important Democrats are to good accountability on national security, and because Republicans have so much deference that it's up to the Democrats to kind of, like, really hold their feet to the fire. But I think if you think of the dove's curse as a product of the Democrats feeling like they need to keep Republicans' support to do stuff, the example that I come back to is, you know, Joe Biden had a real approval hit in after the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And one could debate how real that was or how much it was connected. But I mean, I think there's a fair amount of polling data that shows that that was a precipitous, you know, decline.
And not necessarily about the decision itself, if I understand the polling right. About the perception of incompetent execution.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, prior to the withdrawal itself was actually pretty popular among both parties. I mean, Trump was the one who wanted to do it, you know, and made the deal with the Taliban. And in another time, one might have said, well, that would have been the end of Joe Biden's presidency. And a few months later, he got the Inflation Reduction Act.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, if the Inflation Reduction Act was always going to come down to Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema, right, it was going to be 51-49, no matter what, then it lowers the agenda costs. And that's a reduction in the kind of pressure on the doves. Not doesn't eliminate it, but it makes it easier for leaders from dovish parties to make a dovish move that they really believe is in the national interest, because they don't fear so much that it's going to hurt their political capital in other ways. And so that's one, I mean, polarization has a lot of bad outcomes and effects on national security, but that's one, you know, lessening the pressure on doves to fight for other reasons when they don't think it's, that to me is an upside. But I don't know. I mean, I think the real problem is that it's one thing to say elites have preferences and ambitions and careers, and we need to take that into account. And they also have policy preferences. But right now, bargaining over these outcomes is almost gone. And it's partly because the incentives for investing in expertise and developing those really strong policy preferences is so reduced. And it's not reduced in a symmetric way. It's much reduced on the Republican side. And my recent foreign affairs piece gets into this. What you want is to have incentives aligned so that the career ambitions and good policies are sort of incentivized in the same direction, right? And that it pays to have somebody invest in policy preferences. It doesn't have to be on foreign policy. Because you want people to be able to trade with people who care about other things. But there has to be some potential for crossover bargaining. And it just doesn't seem like that matters very much anymore. And that is troubling because that is a crucial link to elites are really important for accountability. If the voters aren't going to be holding their leaders to account, or they can only do it every 4 years, they need those elites to be filling the void and passing judgment in a substantive way. Not all of them, but some of them have to.
Yeah.
You need to have like the foreign policy gurus in the Senate and so forth. And I think right now we're in a situation where we've got a Speaker of the House who holds the fate of Ukraine essentially in his hands, or at least as of today when we're recording this. But that, you know, the whole other conversation is like the idea of the party of Reagan not taking a strongly confrontational stance against Russia just boggles the mind.
Right. That's that whole perceptions issue, right? The long lag effect of perceptions that, you know, Republicans are national security hawks and Democrats are national security doves, and how, you know, things can flip and change. It's happened before in American politics and it could happen again. But I want to foot stomp one thing you said here, which is it's easy to take away from a lot of this conversation and a lot of just inherently by focusing on elites and the pushing and pulling influence they have, and they must be bought off in order to go along with, you know, this or that, that it can come across as cynical or at least highly skeptical. It can come across as even, you know, borderline pejorative or negative about elites. But you have a crucial point there, which I think comes out just as much, which is that especially after a war begins, elites are an important source of accountability and constraint. And that's important not to lose that in the shuffle, that elites, you know, play multiple functions here, not just on the side that probably gets the most attention.
Well, right. I can remember when we thought the 2008 election, I mean, the Democratic primary revolved so much around Iraq. It's one of the few cases where you had two candidates and one turned out to be on the right side of the issue from a public opinion standpoint, and the other was on the wrong side. And by the time the election rolled around, you'd had a massive financial collapse, and it was not about Iraq at all. So I think as a voter, you want elites to be incentivized to pay attention in a substantive way and exert the constraints they have, because the story of democratic politics and foreign policy, small d democratic politics and foreign policy, right? Capital is the party. This is one of those things in life I just sort of never quite like clicked with me, but is one of constraints on paper and those constraints not being used very much in real life, right? Congress power of the purse is a really hard thing to use as a cudgel in wartime.
Well, this is the time in our conversations when I pull out the chatterbox and reach in to get a random question for you. Elizabeth, name one dead political or national security related leader from any era who we could really use right now.
Goodness. I'm going to pick Cold War era committee chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations and Armed Services Committees.
That is a great Jeopardy category, by the way.
Yes.
Could limit it to just
that. You
that
and I
really
could probably
a lot of
dig it out for... And I picked the category because if you pick any one of them, you might end up with like segregationist, racist. I don't pick them because they were such wonderful people. Mm-hmm. Many times they really weren't. But in general, there was greater incentive for people to acquire power and committee chairmanship via committee chairmanships so that they could actually use that power, invest in their expertise, and then use that power to make policy bargains, to conduct oversight. They didn't always do it, but the incentives were pushing them in favor of investing in expertise and therefore acquiring power that was prestigious, right? Used to be anybody worth their salt had to do a stint on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee if they wanted to run for president, right? Mm-hmm. Kennedy maneuvered his way on right when he was first elected to the Senate, which must have been some kind of family back channel or something. Now people rotate off. Like they don't, it's not considered a prestigious post anymore. And why does it matter? Because that's how you, again, you weaken the elite constraints, and that's not great for national security. So I would say strong and long-serving committee chairman of the major foreign policy-related committees in Congress.
You realize, you know, long-serving is not a popular view with people advocating term limits.
No, right? No. But I think that, I mean, actually, I do think there's a, and again, I risk alienating all the listeners you have that are congressional scholars, but I think there's a view that term limits really undermines that kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it just has all kinds of knock-on effects. It means that you can't have bargaining over policy across mm-hmm. issues, right? Sam Nunn can't strike mm-hmm. a deal with somebody else who does tax policy or something.
Yeah.
I worry a lot about the state of congressional knowledge about nuclear weapons, for example, in the age of tripolar nuclear competition. I mean, the late great Jan Nolan, this was her crusade, was to bring more knowledge into the congressional staff space.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the problem with term limits, is that it undermines the incentive to really like get to know and own an issue and be the one who you get that person that you bring along votes.
That's right. Well, I want to thank you for writing The Insider's Game. It is a great book, now available after more than a few years. And I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and chatting so long about it.
It was really fun. Thank you for having me. And I hope that the book is not as cynical as maybe I felt when I was writing it.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter @ thatwaschatter.